one, I should just say I'm in many respects setting the stage for Bruce and Darren, who are going to be giving very concrete examples of implementation of STD telehealth programs. I was asked to give some background on telehealth broadly and some examples of some innovative programs, not necessarily being applied to STD care. I think a lot of what we're hoping is that the audience here, you know, in the Q&A will have some discussion about how might some of these models that may not have been applied to STD care yet be applied to STD care in the future. So a lot of what we're doing, I think, is catalyzing thought and hopefully some discussion about how some things that have been innovative in other areas could be applied to STD care and treatment. So I'm at the University of New Mexico in the internal medicine department. I work in the HIV clinic with my colleague Elaine Thomas, who's in the back there, and I work with Project ECHO as one of the associate directors. I'm initially going to start out actually just talking about telehealth, and I want to thank some of my colleagues, John Scott and Brian Wood at the University of Washington, who lent me a number of slides to kind of set the stage on telemedicine and telehealth. So telehealth really is a broad term that can be applied to many different approaches to using technology to educate and provide direct patient care. I think we think of telemedicine as much more clinically focused and often more patient focused in terms of patient care in more specifically in a clinical way. So, you know, this can encompass everything from live face-to-face consultations using video conferencing, store and forward, meaning there may be, you know, a clinician may take a photograph of a dermatologic of rash or something, send an email with the image to an expert to get consultation on that, or send a question, something like that. There's a whole field of remote monitoring that's opening up and using the Internet of Things with our Fitbits and all kinds of other things as we're monitoring, you know, our heart rates and weight and glucose and all those sorts of things. Many of those are getting, that data is getting reported over the Internet directly to clinicians and healthcare workers. And then the area that I am much more familiar with and we'll talk more at length is the idea of case-based telementoring. And Project ECHO, which I'll be talking about, is a case-based teleconferencing, telementoring situation. In terms of telemedicine and patient consultations, once again, these are examples from the University of Washington that started multiple patient consultation programs, including teleburns, teledermatology, maternal fetal medicine, telemonitoring program, telepsychiatry, travel medicine, all of this happening where clinicians are sitting in one place and bridging geographic distance, which may be five blocks away in a poorer section of town away from the university or a FQHC down the street, or it could be on the other side of the state in a rural area. Virtual clinics, this is another area the University of Washington's really been innovative in, where patients who could be in this picture showing sitting in their home, you know, dial in to pay $20 for 20 minutes or $40 for 20 minutes or something like that, and, you know, dial in and get a primary care provider who has a direct video conference consultation with them. You know, I think thinking about how would this work for STDs, well, I think syndromic care, there are probably a number of ways this could work. This is the UW system where they have a bit of a triage system where a patient kind of goes in, starts, you know, clicks a number of things about the problem they're trying to get consultation on, and the system either triages them to, you need to go to the ER, or you need to go in and be seen by someone, or you're asking a question that we think actually could be addressed using this virtual consult system. These are just some data on virtual clinic results. There's been a lot of patient satisfaction. I mean, certainly being able 24/7 in their system is a 24/7 system. If someone has a URI and they're just not getting over it and it's 11 o'clock at night on Saturday and they don't want to go wait 3 hours in the ER, being able to talk about that with a provider is very attractive. e-consults, this is really where a primary care provider sends an email to a specialist asking a question and asking for recommendations, specialty recommendations. The way their system works, they turn around responses within 24 hours. So that makes it so that a primary care provider could write that clinician, get the answer, schedule their patient back 2 days later, be able to hopefully address their clinical concern. This is just an example of a hematology e-consult provider who may be in the same state, maybe in a different state, replying with some recommendations. In these systems, I mean, like in all consultations, the clinician who asked the question is the provider of record. They have the doctor-patient relationship legally. They're responsible for whatever they end up prescribing or doing. The consultant is simply giving recommendations. There are issues around expanding these types of models. I mean, there have been some challenges with reimbursement. I know in Washington, the legislature has passed legislation that has made it easier for this kind of work to happen and for reimbursement to happen. There are credentialing and licensing issues if you start going across states. And getting physicians to accept this, there have been challenges to that, workflow, et cetera. You know, I mean, on the one hand, certainly from a patient satisfaction point of view, being able to have 24/7 access to clinicians, we would all like that. From the provider standpoint, the idea of being on call 24/7 all the time, that's challenging, and figuring out how to really balance that. Most of us in practice don't necessarily want to be responding to consults every hour on our smartphones. I just wanted to highlight a couple of really great programs I've been familiar with. These, once again, are UW programs. HIV Web Study is a case-based online learning CME activity. David Spock and Joel Gallant set this up a number of years ago. There are about 30 to 40 cases. Each of them takes about an hour to go through. When I worked for CDC in Vietnam, this is how I got my CME. And I could do it any time, day or night, and I got all 30 hours of CME through the system. They're very high quality cases. I know David Spock spends about 20 to 40 hours developing each case, and I think there absolutely could be an STD web study. UW, so that was funded by HRSA. CDC founded a very compelling model, and John Ward, who runs the Division of Viral Hepatitis, funded UW to create a hepatitis C web study based on the same model. That went very well. Actually, it was a hepatitis web study. It covers hep B and hep C. And then they were asked to develop really like a 40-hour-plus online hep C course that covers everything from epidemiology to care and treatment, and is a really fabulous resource, and I recommend that people look at it. It's a great way to get CME, and I think these are worth, the STD community should be looking at these as something they may want to emulate. So Project Echo. So we started 13 years ago at the University of New Mexico, and it was started by Sanjeev Arora. He's a hepatologist. The problem he was trying to address was that there are 35,000 patients in New Mexico with hep C, and he was the only person treating hep C 13 years ago. And so that, you can just do the math there, not going to address that epidemic anytime soon. So he thought, what if I could get primary care clinicians all over the state to agree to be mentored by him over a video network where they would come every week for an hour, present their own hep C patients, he would give them guided practice and mentoring, and they could treat their patients locally. So that was the whole idea, and that's what started the program 13 years ago. It's now expanded to about 40-plus different health conditions, and we have a goal of improving the lives of 1 billion people around the world over the next 10 years. The methodology is pretty simple. None of the individual components are innovative. What I think is innovative about the model is that it bundles these components in what was a new way. So it was using video conference technology. Originally it was Polycom, which is very expensive and limited how many places people had to go sit in a conference room, and the equipment was pretty expensive. Luckily today, with whether it's Vidyu, we use Zoom. There are a lot of web-based, cloud-based platforms that if you can connect to the internet, your smartphone or tablet or laptop or anything, you can participate in a video conference over that platform. So the cost has just dramatically decreased and the flexibility of the platforms has dramatically increased. For us, the core of this model is case-based learning. It's how medical students, fellows, residents learn to go from being a novice to being competent at being practitioners and nurses and pharmacists. It's how business school students learn about operational improvement and quality improvement. And Bruce is going to talk about UW as an STD echo that's a operational focused echo. It's a guided practice, telementoring. The whole idea is there's mentoring going on between people, mid-career professionals, wanting to either learn a new skill or improve the quality of the work they're doing. And very importantly is this community of practice that's developed among the people engaged, the learners and the experts. We promote also a disease management model, standardizing the approach using templates that guide the learners as they're collecting clinical information and when they present that information over the network so that it's very succinct, that the information is presented in a standard manner that everyone knows what's supposed to come next. Using and reinforcing clinical guidelines, whether they're national guidelines or professional society guidelines, and then monitoring and evaluating outcomes. Also, all our sessions include a 15 or 20 minute didactic where an expert will give a very short, adult learning centered didactic. This is just going over sort of the telehealth, telemedicine, or one version of the differences. Telemedicine primarily addresses the issue of geography and spanning geography. In the case of what we're doing in terms of the tele-echo clinics, we're really focused on workforce development. It's training practitioners who then go out and take care of many patients is the idea. The idea also is these communities are interactive and there's, multi-directional learning where everyone's an expert, the clinicians in their local context are expert at getting the work done there. So often the learning is going in all directions, and I think the peer-to-peer learning really is, in many respects, the most important aspect of this. Collaborative problem solving and co-managing the cases, et cetera, is very much part of this. Also bridge building. We really try to bring together academic medical centers, departments of health, or ministries of health overseas, private practitioners, public sector, whether it's the VA, Indian Health Service, FQHCs, et cetera, Department of Health clinics for STDs or Hep C, TB. The platform really flattens and makes it possible for all these sectors that have been so divided, certainly in the U.S. healthcare system, to be more integrated. Also being able to really bring multidisciplinary care to bear. So experts in medicine, nursing, social work, pharmacy, lab, all being able to come together. And on the local site, ideally bringing as many of those elements together as well. This is just a sort of snapshot of the 2011 New England Journal article, which I would recommend to anyone who wanted to learn more about this, focusing on a prospective cohort study that was done of Hep C patients in New Mexico. These were the sites in many of the clinics across the state that participate in our Hep C echo. The blue dots are the squares are prisons, actually. So as many people probably know, nearly 50% of the prison population is infected with Hep C, at least in New Mexico. There are about almost 500 patients enrolled in the study, about a third of them going to the academic medical center, two-thirds staying in the community and being treated by their local primary care clinicians, nurses, doctors, and pharmacists. In New Mexico, we can treat with pharmacists. In the Indian Health Service, it does a lot of Hep C treatment with pharmacists. And the outcomes were really equivalent. The cure rates, the SVRs in the community were equal to those at the university. So this really addressed this issue of, you know, Sanjeev Arora was treating about 100 patients a year for Hep C back in 2004. He's now treating more with the direct acting agents. It is easier. There's still some complexities to the algorithms. But now, you know, 4/5 of the patients being treated are being treated in the community, and we're treating at least 1,300 patients a year instead of 100 patients a year. In terms of some of the benefits to the clinicians, they're getting knowledge they didn't have before through a very easily accessible format. We are able to create these communities where peer-to-peer learning can happen. For many providers, particularly in isolated rural areas, it helps reduce their isolation and give a sense of professional satisfaction by linking. I mean, my experience, I was the TB and helped with HIV in Shiprock on the Navajo reservation for a number of years. And many of my colleagues weren't really interested in TB or STDs or HIV. And they, you know, didn't necessarily want to talk about those things. So being able to know that I had an hour a week where I was going to be able to talk about HIV or TB or STDs with a bunch of my peers across an area that wanted to talk about that. Usually I would just see them once a year at a conference like you all are doing here. So imagine if you all could actually be interacting every week of the year. Hopefully that would be a lot better. We provide no-cost CMEs, and for many people that's a great incentive. In many respects, this is a quality improvement program, and it's absolutely a workforce training and education program. It's also been a really nice opportunity to integrate public health and mix public health perspectives with clinical perspectives and QI perspectives as well. For us, as we've expanded to other diseases, in thinking about what diseases make sense to invest the time and energy that goes into this, both by the experts and the participants, the diseases need to be common enough that it makes sense to make that investment. The management has to be complex enough that you're not going to, in 1 hour, teach them how to do it, and then they're going to go do it. I mean, it needs to be complex, and treatment needs to be changing frequently enough that coming back week after week, they're going to be learning something. This just lists that we have over 25 programs serving people in New Mexico from all kinds of different health areas. We also have a number of collaborations with the Indian Health Service that are national, and with the CDC, there's a population health program that is with the Center for Chronic Disease that links up about 20 different grantees, 11 tribal epicenters across Indian country, and a number of tribal public health programs. We also have a number of CHW programs we support. These are just our partners. There are about 30 plus states in the U.S. that are implementing ECHO programs, many of them out of academic medical centers. Globally, this is where we are now in terms of partners implementing programs around the world. You can see that after that 2011 article, the uptick in replication around the world was pretty dramatic, and I think that article really did have a lot to do with that. We collaborate with the Department of Defense, the Army and Navy. They came to us wanting to establish some chronic pain programs to be able. They have very few experts in chronic pain, and they've got chronic pain happening all over the world. So they needed to get that expertise around. The VA runs actually about 20 to 30 different programs out of their academic medical center VA hospitals. This just lists many of the different programs and which ones have been replicated the most. And one STD, HIV, the reminder of where the epidemic is globally. This just shows where the different HIV ECHO programs are happening globally, many of them with PEPFAR support in Africa. The first one launched in Namibia in November last year. It's a collaboration between the Ministry of Health and CDC and a number of other partners, including us. So basically, they are linking, and they just finished the pilot last week, 10 hospitals that serve 60,000 HIV patients around Namibia, and they're averaging 80 to 100 doctors and nurses coming together over this network, presenting cases and discussing them. These are just some other pictures. TB, and I just wanted to show this because 2 years ago I had a chance to talk at the NTCA meeting, the National TB Controllers meeting here, to pitch this idea as a new idea to the TV community. And in the last 2 years, nearly 10 programs have started globally. Hopefully this is what's going to happen. That's my hope with the STD community. Dr. Nguyen, so luckily we've got Mary Kam here, former CDC director of Vietnam. I'm sure she recognizes Dr. Nguyen. He's the director of the National TB Program in Vietnam. Almost 2 years ago, they launched the first TB Echo in the world, and they linked 54 TB hospitals around Vietnam to talk about MDR cases. It's gone really well. This is just highlighting in New Mexico, where we're a low-incidence state. Vietnam treats 100,000 TB patients a year. In New Mexico, we treat 50 TB patients a year. So both ends of the spectrum have different needs. In our case, it's keeping expertise going. When a public health nurse only sees a TB case every 3 years, you know, we need to keep her up to date on what's happening with TB so that when next week she has an active case, she knows what to do and can get help with it. University of Washington had their one-year anniversary with their TB Echo program. It's focused more on private practitioners and in TB infection. The Navajo Nation is an interesting tribal state and federal collaboration. Kenya, I'm here just trying to give examples of how this has really been implemented in very different contexts. Kenya launched a program a month ago. And we're working in a couple months to set up a cross-border U.S.-Mexico border TB program. India is launching theirs. And I'm going to take 10 more seconds just to say we link every quarter the program directors of these different initiatives to help them share their experience and best practices as they're setting up these different programs for a kind of programmatic sharing that's going on. And last thing, we use this model actually to get STD guidelines out on Navajo in a kind of single session, which was a great way to get guidelines out. One of your newest STDs, Zika. So actually the AAP just announced last week they're going to be launching a Zika Echo, which we will be helping them with, which is going to be exciting. And just want to give a shout out to the New York State Department of Health. Next week, they will be launching the first STD Echo, and I'm sure they would love everyone to join them, maybe not for the first one, but I bet they're going to welcome anyone to join after that. And I had some summary slides. I think I've actually covered most of my points in those slides, and I'm out of time. So, and actually, my colleagues are going to talk about a number of particular implementations of Echo for other areas. So thank you.